Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to the 12th annual New Venture Competition at UC Santa Barbara. I'm Bob York. I'm the director of the program. I'm just going to say a few words and we'll get started right away. This is about the teams and students today, not about the so much about the program. But I did want to say a few things about today's event and the judges that we have here. This is really the culmination of a lot of hard work, and not only by the young entrepreneurs, of course, but also the mentors in the local community that have spent so much time here during the last 4 months. And our terrific staff of TMP. Hopefully you'll get to meet some of them later today. We've also benefited really tremendously from a lot of the donors that have contributed to the program, and we'll acknowledge them individually at the end today. We've got this year over $75,000 in cash and in-kind support, which is a record for our program. Most of those donors and mentors are going to be listed by name on the loop that's running behind me, so I hope you get a chance to see some of their names. As a newcomer to TMP myself, I've only been on the job for 9 months or so. It's been truly remarkable how much effort goes into this thing. The students, of course, putting in a lot of effort, the mentors, tremendous effort. So it's really been an honor for me to be part of the program. As you might expect, it's a bit of a Darwinian test for the people that are involved. We started out with 130 students, 40 teams of ideas. And in January, they started biweekly mentoring sessions at 7 o'clock in the morning. That ran twice a week for several months. Over time, we ran that down to about 20 teams, and then 20 teams entered our semifinal competition in mid-April. The format today is really not unlike what these entrepreneurs will face in the real world, giving a pitch to a bunch of venture capitalists. And in fact, we have several on the panel today. We're really honored to have the four judges today. I'll single them out by name. Dan Burnham, former CEO of Raytheon Corp, also a real tireless worker on campus as chairman of the UCSB Foundation. Mr. Larry Burrells, successful entrepreneur, former founder and CEO of Wavefront Technologies, currently at Pacific Capital Resources. Mr. Greg Kaiser, Chief Portfolio Architect at Intellectual Ventures. And Mr. Raman Khanna, who's a general partner at Onset Ventures in the Bay Area, and also Raman's the proud dad of a gaucho. It's important to also note that the student teams you're hearing from aren't receiving any credit for doing this. The mentors aren't getting paid for their time. And the judges also aren't getting paid for their time. So all of these people are motivated by just one common desire, and that's to do something very innovative, creating something new, making a positive contribution to society, maybe even changing the world. Some of these ideas have potential to do that. So I think I speak for everyone when I say that these efforts aren't just worthy of recognition, but actually celebrating this. This is an important thing for our community and state and country. Over the years, a lot of the companies that have been formed out of this competition are still around and thriving, and we're very proud of that. But this is really more than just an entrepreneurship program. The TMP Technology Management Program mission is really to add value to the students' experience here at UCSB. And in doing so, we hope that people find greater success when they leave the university. And there's no doubt in my mind that all of the participants in this competition are benefiting from the program and the competition itself. So with that in mind, I'm going to introduce my partner in crime here, Bill Grant, who's our external program manager, to go over the ground rules, and then we'll get started with the presentations. Okay, thank you.
You'll notice I have that although the initial meeting started in January for team formation and so on, I've got the feeling a lot of these teams were working last June on some of their ideas, because there's some pretty sophisticated presentations coming your way. Structurally, we'll have a 10-minute presentation followed by 10 minutes of Q&A with the judges, and the teams are in isolation, and we do everything we can to make sure that it's exactly the same for the first team presenting as it is for the sixth team presenting. They have no electronic devices whatsoever, so they have no insight as to perhaps the nature of the questions that might be being asked of them.
My name is Greg Goodwin, loving TMP member, just like my teammates right here, Andrew Riddle and Jason Sreet Singh. We are Replica Therapeutics, and we strive to make safe blood for all. Our technology was developed and patented by the passion to find a new way to save human life by two of our core team members, Drs. Nishit Doshi and PhD Purnima Kohar, right here in our own chemical engineering department at UC Santa Barbara. So our mission is pretty simple, to provide medical institutions with a safe, storable, portable, and universally acceptable substitute for human blood to save countless lives across the planet. So the problem is pretty obvious. Millions of patients do not have access to safe blood after incidents of trauma, such as an injured SEAL in Afghanistan, car accident victim on the freeway, even in our own operating rooms in our hospitals here in the US. As you can see here, 85 million units of blood are donated annually, but we need a minimum of 135 more million units on top of that. So there's a huge demand for blood or blood substitutes, over double the current supply that we still need today. Further, there's a bunch of problems that we have with current methods of blood, human blood transfusion. Human blood's shelf life, as many of you may know, is only 42 days when it's stored perfectly. Matching blood type on site is still completely not feasible. And there's the obvious problem of disease transmission. Over half of all the units of blood donated in developing countries, and still too high of a percentage in developed countries such as our own, is never once screened for any transmissible disease whatsoever. And this, in 2009, the WHO said caused over 185,000 new cases of HIV and over 500,000 hepatitis illnesses just from blood transfusions affected with other people's disease. But we have a solution. SynBlood is our technology, and what it does is it synthetically mimics the two of the main components of blood, red blood cells and platelets. So based on this platform technology, we have two main products, SynRBC and SynPlat, each of which have three distinct applications we can use them for. First off is just purely synthetic blood for blood volume. So for RBCs, we have blood volume and the ability to carry oxygen throughout the body. And for platelets, we have more blood volume and the ability to clot during bleeding and to fight plaque in your arteries. On top of that, you can combine our product with image diagnostics, with markers, for image diagnostics. So you could say, combine our SynPlat with an image marker, put that patient in an MRI, and there will be a concentration of glowing markers wherever there's a concentration of plaque in the arteries. So we can diagnose exactly where there's a clot in the artery, which is something we still can't do today. And on top of that is therapeutic applications. When we synthesize our two products, we can combine them with drugs to do things such as combine them with chemotherapy drugs for cancer patients and anticoagulants to prevent stroke. So you can see how many potential applications there are out of our synthetic blood platform. So we're going to focus first on SynRBC and its oxygen carrying capacity, because that's where most of our R&D has been focused so far. So our first product is SynRBC. What it is a packet of 200 milliliters of freeze-dried SynRBC, synthetic red blood cells, in a packet which is comparable, that's the exact amount of blood cells that are in one unit of blood during a normal blood transfusion. And what you do is you combine them on-site, simply just combine it on-site with a saline solution and inject it right into the body for a concentration of red blood cells. And you can see here, it's pretty cheap for us to do this compared to your average costs of today's human blood. So, our technology uses only biocompatible and biodegradable components, all of which have already been approved by the FDA on their own. What we do is we begin with a PLGA core. We layer hemoglobin on top of it, dissolve it with the solvent, and what you get is a synthetic cell very similar to real red blood cells. So this diagram shows that the size of our SYN-RBC is exactly the same as natural blood cells. It has the exact same biconcave discoidal shape, which is yet to be done in science, and mechanical properties very close to natural blood cells. So, here's my favorite picture or slide of the presentation. This is an image we captured in our labs of our SYN-RBC right next to real blood cells. Can you guys tell the difference? So here's the real red blood cells. Here's our SYN-RBC. You guys can see how similar these look. And this is an actual image we took at the microscopic level in our labs. So competition we're going to face for SYN-RBC obviously starts off with the current human blood market. But beyond that, big pharma, biotech companies, they're working on methods such as molecular hemoglobin and perfluorochemicals for blood substitutes. But none of these have been able to pass clinical trials. There are some other competition, such as blood farming techniques, but these are all still emerging technologies and haven't yet entered the phases required to get FDA approval in the US. So we plan to beat all this competition because we can be what our product is used whenever there's an immediate dire need for red blood cells. What it does, it eliminates most of the costs associated with regular human blood transfusions, such as shelf life and storage. Our product is extended from the 42 days of human blood up to years in our freeze-dried sealed packet. It's universally compatible because there's no antigens on it. It's just purely red blood cells. And it's a disease-free solution because it's not coming from another human being. It's simply made in our labs, all completely safe. So these two images, the first one on the left shows an image we took of our SYN-RBC passing through a glass capillary, smaller in diameter than the actual blood cell you can see on the outside of it, which is one of the toughest things science has found to be able to create synthetic red blood cells. And the one image on the right illustrates how our SYN-RBC has almost exactly the same oxygen carrying capacity of real blood cells. All right, so what we plan to do is there's many, many people that could benefit from our product. We're going to start off by selling to the military. You can imagine an application, a SEAL is shot in Afghanistan. What we can do is we can inject them with a concentration of red blood cells, giving them the oxygen carrying capacity and blood volume to give them that time to get to a proper hospital where we can then give them a proper transfusion. We can sell it to mobile medical units. You can imagine an ambulance going to a car accident victim on the freeway. We can't do a transfusion on site because we have no idea what type of blood that victim has or how much blood we're going to require. So now, just like with the SEAL, we can inject them with the RBCs, giving them the time they need to get to a hospital where we can give them the full blood and save their life. And then, obviously, we can sell to medical institutions across the planet, right from big metropolitan hospitals in Los Angeles down to rural clinics in Africa, Asia, India. Anywhere where there's a dire need for quick, safe access to blood, and they don't have that access. And the demand for blood has been growing steadily at least 7% every single year. So obviously there's not much end in the market for blood. So what we need to do is obviously there's a bunch of barriers to entry in the biotech pharmaceutical industry. These are mainly research and development costs associated with getting a new product through the three phases required to gain FDA approval in the US. But we have a plan. What we're going to do is secure our initial and the majority of our funding from government organizations like DARPA, NIH, and NSF, which we've already applied for several. and begin phase one testing. We only need about $500,000 in investment to begin these testing. And after we're through phase one, we'll begin entertaining offers to sell, license, or be acquired by a big pharmaceutical company. But if we're not satisfied with our ROI here, and we're confident enough to enter phase two, we'll just secure more grant funding, secure about $500,000 in private funding so we can get through phase two clinical trials. And about 2 years after that, once we're complete with phase two clinical trials, we're pretty confident that we could be acquired by a large pharmaceutical company and provide an optimal return on investments for ourselves and the investors, somewhere in the realm of $100 million plus. So with that, thank you guys so much for your time. We're Replica Therapeutics, and again, I appreciate so much being here. So thank you guys.
It's powerful. What are the one or two things that are most likely to cause you fits in the next 2 years? And what would be your likely recovery plan?
I'm sorry, to cause what? Can you repeat
that? Problems.
To cause problems?
Major problems.
Okay. Well, there are various risks involved with the development of a product like this. So we realize that there's inherent risk involved with preclinical studies. Our major milestones will be to bring our product to animal testing in preclinical studies so that it is proved to be non-toxic when we bring it to phase one trials, which is when we will start implementing it into human patients. So that's going to be a significant milestone for us. Also, to secure enough grant funding to begin research at the labs here at UCSB.
One question I had was about your competition. You said there are a lot of companies that have been started in this space, but you said none of them were able to get FDA approval. How long have they tried, and what were the key reasons why they didn't get there?
The current blood substitutes that are out on the market are these large biotech companies, pharmaceutical companies, have attempted to develop these products, but they're all at the molecular level. So molecular hemoglobin and perfluorochemicals have proven to be toxic in human beings at the molecular level when they're not combined on top of a particle or within a particle like ours is. So our platform technology, SynPlatelet, has already been developed and tested in vivo studies inside of mice, and they have proven to be non-toxic in these mice. So we are confident that SynRBC will prove the same demonstration.
Just a quick follow-on. Have you been able to figure out how much on average these companies have spent on trials in order to try to get FDA approval?
Yeah, opinions vary according to different entrepreneurial blogs that we have read. We estimate that overall it'll cost somewhere in the range of $25 million to bring our product completely through clinical trials, and that includes preclinical studies as well.
I guess. Oh, I don't have to push anything. Awesome. High tech. The impressive business plan, you guys are definitely to be complimented. One of the things that really I didn't understand that you had a good handle on, maybe you could help me, is you talk about your raw material cost being $65 a unit, and you talk about how competition sells it for between $300 to $450. The Red Cross, if I understand correctly, has almost no cost for the unit other than the cost of harvesting it when people go donate it. Do you have a good handle, though, on the rest of the cost, what makes up that $450 that it costs the Red Cross? And will you be able to be competitive with your raw materials costing, like, you know, a sizable portion of what the final product cost is going to be?
Yeah, that's a great question. We interviewed a manager at the blood bank at Kaiser Permanente in Los Angeles. My uncle is a clinical perfusionist at a hospital in LA, and he put me into contact with him. He said that the reason the Red Cross charges so much, and they do sell human blood to specific medical institutions such as Kaiser, the reason that they charge so much is because there are salaries that are involved, there are people involved with the testing, the acquiring of this human blood, and all of the tests that go along with it, making sure that it is safe before it is administered, and then also the refrigeration storage cost is also a large issue. So that is why they're able to charge such a premium. Also, because in certain areas, like in LA, there is a higher demand. There is also a less overall donation percentage. So in places like LA, they're able to charge much more for one unit of human blood than they are in, let's say, Midwest, where there's a higher percentage donation rate to overall population.
And then also, sorry, real quick, for the $65 production cost, that's solely what it costs us to produce just one unit in our lab with everything, just one. Just like any standard drug, we could get that down to scaling. Our advisors believe it could be down to a dollar or less per unit if we were on the same scaling as a standard drug.
Okay, thanks. Just a quick follow-on. You understand what their costs are in reaching the 450, but what will your costs be in delivering a final product? What are your additional costs other than the 65? Is what I was wondering if you had a handle on.
One of the major costs I think it'll be involved with our product would be the logistics part. Trying to, like if we're focusing on clinics in Asia or Africa, I think that our major cost would be logistics to get our product into you know, our customers' hands. So that's probably, you know, like Red Cross is pretty much ubiquitous everywhere, like in the world. So it's, you know, they have the infrastructure where they need to provide to transport that. So initially, that would be our main cost initially to set up or partner with their existing logistic companies to transport our product.
My question is a follow-on to that. So have you done a reasonable assessment of once you have a product of this nature, how you would distribute it?
Well, it is just in a freeze-dried sealed packet with no limits on like standard heating through even just regular U.S. mail. It would be completely fine to send it across the globe. So distribution really isn't too much of a problem of ours. That's one of the huge advantages it has over human blood is we don't need a perfect temperature. It's already manufactured from the plant in a sealed container where you just pop it open with the saline solution on site to inject the RBCs.
And the reason somebody is going to use your product versus another is cost.
Costs and also the problems that are associated with real human blood. Even though we have methods to screen for diseases here in the United States, there still is a chance that you're able to contract some type of transmissible disease. It's not impenetrable to error. So somebody, a patient might opt, or maybe even because of their religious background, I've heard of cases where people will refuse a human blood transplant or transfusion from another human being. So it all depends on what the patient wants and also what the medical institution deems to be more sufficient at the site of trauma.
And one final question. What amount of dollars would you expect to get on an annual basis from grant funding?
Well, from what I understand about grant funding is that it's spaced out and there's a streamlined process, especially from I believe it's the SBIR grant from the National Institute of Health. They distribute it out evenly over a certain period of time and over phases. So there's several different grants that we can apply for and have already applied for. And we believe that we'll contract enough money across these different grants to be able to fund our research.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Adam Zubri. This is Devin Morrison, and over here is Ryan Baird. We are revolutionizing the process that mobile employees use to clock into work. We are Sync-In. Currently in the construction industry, companies are losing tens of thousands of dollars each year because they have no effective way to track employees in the field. Billions of dollars are lost in the industry as a whole. The vast majority of companies still use paper timesheets, for which employee time theft is rampant. Additional expenses are going towards recording these timesheets. We are developing the solution. Using a combination of location and voice authentication, we save employers multiples of what they spend on our solution. So, how are we different? We offer a unique combination of features that ensures employees are where and who they say they are when they're clocking in. Current solutions only offer location tracking using smartphones, which are far from prevalent in the construction industry. We have partnered with a company with over 50 employees to beta test our platform over the summer, who will also be our first customer when we go live in fall. We have negotiated significant discounts with access network location data with cell carriers. Sync-In offers multilingual support to accommodate the diversity in the construction industry. We have not found another solution that does this. Additionally, we have an expert of over 20 years who will be on our core team and help us become a company that can truly relate to our target market. The Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that the average hourly wage of construction employees is $18 an hour. If an employee shows up a few minutes late and leaves 10 minutes early each day, this adds up to 15 minutes or $5 a day, which translates to $1,000 per year for each employee. Between accounting hours to record these timesheets, the expensive burden on labor, and other overhead, losses are easily double this number. Sync-In costs $240 per year. As you can see, Sync-In offers a truly strong value proposition. Oops. Okay. Our solution starts with a caller. The caller calls a number powered by Sync-In. Our servers then pick up and handle the phone call. Immediately after the call begins, satellites and cell towers begin triangulating their location. Once their location is verified, the employee provides their name, which is then matched to a biometric server and ensures that the employee is who they say they are. Once the entire match is made, the clock-in is then sent to and saved on our servers, where it can be accessed via our website. From there, it can be integrated into payroll services and software such as ADP and QuickBooks, as well as downloaded in an Excel sheet. This whole process takes a few seconds. Let me show you. Ryan will now call Sync-In.
Thank you for calling Sync-In.
Ryan Baird.
Thank you for syncing in, Ryan. Goodbye.
As you can see, when we reload the page, there's a time clock entry with the time, the date, the number, and the location that Ryan just clocked in from. Our financial expert and marketing expert, Devin, will now walk you through the process of bridging the gap to our customers.
While doing market research for this product, we found our initial target customer. Several companies on the spot asked us to purchase our device. We found that the characteristics of these companies were mid-range construction companies that had a large number of fieldwork employees that moved from job site to job site. The construction industry is currently using paper timesheets, and our solution is the most efficient method to cure that. The benefit of targeting the construction industry first is its size advantage. The construction industry is one of the nation's largest industries with 7.2 million workers and over 884,000 companies. Our efficiency improvement will be able to give these companies a long-term monetary advantage. This is a great industry to start in, although our solution is not limited to the field of construction. Other possibilities for us to move into are companies that dispatch employees, such as service tech or maintenance. Also, we're looking towards industries of healthcare service and agriculture, where workers work at different locations and work for varied amount of hours. Our solution is also extensible and can be applied to methods such as online education, where verification for testing and time is necessary. As you can see, there are many industries we can expand into. In order to distribute this product, what we're looking to is partnering with payroll companies. Just recently, we met with one of the largest payroll companies in the world, ADP. We met with the Vice President of Sales for Southern California, Bob Grant. ADP has 550,000 customers, with nearly 10% of those customers in the construction industry. Bob Grant said he was very enthusiastic about our product and looked towards future partnership with SyncIn. We specifically discussed integration into bundling with ADP in order to add value to their product and enable them to reach additional customers. This will provide us a method of indirect sales, and we will be able to reach a large customer base. We are not just focusing on SyncIn. We will look towards other payroll companies as a method for expanding our sales and operations. Our sales projections for 5 years total 1,500 customers, and we'll be generating a revenue of over $10 million in the fifth year. One of the advantages to having a software as a service company is we have very low fixed cost to start up, and we'll be reaching a break-even point in the second year. Offering software as a service, we will maintain the customers from year to year, and we'll have a recurring revenue stream. If we're able to partner with the companies we want, besides ADP, and expand numerous payroll companies, we can increase these sales projections and significantly increase profits from what these conservative estimates are. What we're looking for in order to take this product live at the end of summer is an investment. This investment money will go towards licensing the necessary software we need to implement this solution. It will also go towards marketing expenses and the operational expenses to cover the first year of operation. In addition to the $300,000 monetary amount we are looking for in investment, we are looking for investors that will be able to provide industry expertise in the software industry. As a team, we're very confident in our ability to succeed. Only 3 months ago, we started this project. We've conducted a feasibility study, we've developed a working prototype, and we've secured contracts with the cell phone carriers. We've also secured two companies that are willing to beta test our product over the summer, and these will become future customers of ours. With this advantage, we've also started talks with payroll companies, and we understand that this payroll companies, with the use of this investment, we know that we will be a success. We look forward to a time when SyncIn is more than just a company name, but the phrase SyncIn becomes a verb used by thousands and thousands of employees to log in and log out of work every day. Thank you for your time.
What is it that would keep an ADP, for example, of saying thank you very much and going off and doing this on their own without your help?
So, in our meeting with ADP, we brought that up, and they don't have any incentive of getting involved in the time and attendance, ADP specifically. They're more interested, they work with many, many companies for the time and attendance, and they're just interested in doing payroll. And one thing that we discussed was working on an application that could work alongside their application that works with smartphones for employers that does time and attendance while theirs acts as the payroll back end. So they're predominantly interested in just doing the payroll. But our main play is definitely an execution one. We're the first to develop this technology, and we plan to partner with a distribution channel large enough to take a large amount of market share up front.
Thank you.
I was, I think, trying to understand a little bit more about, in terms of, because what you're building, if this thing is deployed by these companies, a mission-critical infrastructure, this is how employers pay their employees, and reliability of the system, and I think, become very important. So have you carefully looked at the cost of building? I mean, sometimes there are systems you can build very cheaply, which are kind of to prototype, but to have a system that has fault tolerance built into it, have you carefully looked at those aspects or consulted with some people who have built these kind of systems to understand what would it actually take to build a reliable system that can scale?
So, yeah, we have looked at that, and we brought that up. We met with somebody who was actually in charge of government operations for a while about security, and that was an issue that he brought up. That's a lot of what our money's hopefully going to go towards is development and ensuring that we do have the cutting-edge technology and the security, but that comes first to anything else that we're doing, is making sure that the data... I mean, we're going to be keeping track of a lot of sensitive data.
I think to add to that, we're looking for investors who value added, who really understand this technology. And so that's something we're really focusing on as far as people who can work with us and want to put money in and want to help us with things like that. So that'd be a focus when we take on funding.
Okay. I have two things that I'd like you to address. The first is you use a cost justification that's based on the level of dishonesty of the employee, and then you're asking for greater than 25% of that as your fee. And without really understanding, I mean, how honest are the employees and so on, in other words, you based it on just sort of a projection that if somebody cheats somebody out of 15 minutes a day or whatever, but you're asking for a very real cost of greater than 25% of that amount only if the employees are dishonest and so on. The second thing that I'd like to understand how you thought about this was, in order to address the user base that you would have to, you'd have to have a contractual arrangement from all the cell phone carriers in the area, and they'd actually have to have coverage in all of the work sites. And I know that you know, I have a hard time getting cell phone coverage at my house sometimes, so I wanted to understand how you address those two issues. Thank you.
I can go ahead and address the first one for you. As far as the value proposition, we estimated an average loss. We did market research that estimates loss due to late logins. We also did market research by asking customers what they thought they were losing to come up with these numbers. As a personal story, I used to work for a valet service that had a time and attendance software program. And it just had loopholes because it didn't offer the methods we use. People would log in for each other for entire 8-hour shifts. So we're estimating 15 minutes is lost a day. Entire shifts are lost sometimes by buddies logging in for each other. Through this voice authentication, we eliminate this. And this is our advantage. So we feel that the value proposition will be easily explained to the employers that know that their inherent nature of their employees to be a little dishonest as far as when they show up.
Most employers that we've talked to are pretty aware of the issue. We haven't come across any employers that say, you know, employees are completely showing up on time and we trust that. And so the value proposition, the problem hasn't been actually a big issue. But we're definitely going to vary the price once we get into the market and pick the most ideal price. Right now it is a projection. And then can you remind me with the second?
It had to do with relationship with all cell phone carriers, right, and having proper coverage at all sites.
So we have contracts signed with pretty much all carriers. Most subsidiary carriers like Boost Mobile use the networks of the larger carriers. They don't set up cell towers throughout the country. So we're pretty much set up with all carriers. As far as the reception goes, we've been talking to employers and working with them to solve this. And an appropriate solution for now seems to be having an option on the website to adjust the radius of the clock-in space where they can clock into job sites. And for the most part, within a fair radius distance of the job site, you can set up spots that there's reception. And most people, I mean, most companies need to communicate with their workers on the job site, so they're aware of where these spots are.
Are all your sales assumed to be indirect sales? You have no idea, plans to build a direct sales organization?
At first, we want to definitely target direct sales to do a proof of concept before we go into indirect sales, but our heavily focused business model is going to be on distribution through other parties.
And what do you expect that the selling cost is per customer?
Per what's our cost or what's the customer's cost?
What is the end cost to you?
The end cost to us is right now, before we can negotiate contracts down, we're looking at about $8 a month per employee, and we're charging 20, between $7 and $8.
Talking the total selling cost. We estimated, based on financials and expenses for sales, a contribution margin of around 63% for the sale after we've retained it. So as far as commission for the sales team, we're offering 25% of the product for the first year with 2% retaining on that. So if the salesperson can make a sale, they're going to be making salaries of what a salesperson will get at that rate, and that's projected into our financials as far as revenue.
And have you looked at your model relative to other companies of comparable size in terms of, it looked to me like your anticipation of margin is substantially higher than what I'm used to seeing. Is that typical? Did you do any research on that, or do you? How did you come to those conclusions?
We looked into other companies in the industry of construction that offer either support software or actual competitors. Some of the competitors' sales were much larger, at 1,000 customers in their first year coming to the business. So we believe that the sales projections of 1,500 customers by the fifth year is pretty reasonable. Does that answer your question?
I think you're asking about the contribution, right? The contribution margin between.
That's correct.
So the primary advantage we're assuming and what we're working with ADP to solve is we won't have, our sales and marketing costs will be significantly lower. And when we looked at most software companies, most of the cost of their product was being allocated to marketing and selling their product, which we won't incur. We'll incur to some extent, but not to the extent that other packages are doing. And through our discussions with ADP, they said that their interest in selling our product would be to sell their own product, not to make commission off of selling our product. So we would retain that surplus.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My name is Scott Ferguson. This is JP Wong. And in the audience is Dr. Jackson Gong. We are the founders of Aptitude Medical Systems. Our vision is long, healthy lives for everyone. And we can achieve this through creating new diagnostics that can enable more sensitive detection. And we can do this faster, better, and cheaper than anyone else. To begin, imagine the following scenario. Alan here has cancer, but he doesn't know it yet, and he could die if he doesn't get early treatment. Our technology could save his life by creating aptamers, a new disease detector. We make the highest performance aptamers faster and cheaper than anyone else. So what stands between Alan and his treatment? It's a diagnostic. And when a person is sick, inside of them is a disease indicator that represents that disease. So the job of the diagnostic is to detect that disease indicator. And how does it do that? With an affinity reagent, a special molecule that's designed specifically for this target. Its job is to bind to the target and give the correct signal to inform the appropriate disease treatment. Unfortunately, there are many disease indicators without affinity reagents, such as for diseases like many cancers, heart disease, and autoimmune diseases. Without the affinity reagent, there is no diagnostic, and with no diagnostic, there is no treatment. Aptitude Medical Systems, so why is there no affinity reagent for many diagnostic targets? Most affinity reagents are actually antibodies, and antibodies have fundamental limitations that place them out of reach of many diagnostic targets. This is where Aptitude Medical Systems comes in. We create a new diagnostic substance called aptamers. These aptamers have the capability to These aptamers have the capability to detect these disease indicators that are otherwise impossible. So we have seen that the lack of versatility in antibodies is a major problem. This is because antibodies can only be generated for immunogenic targets. Aptamers, on the other hand, can be generated for targets of any type, such as drugs, toxins, or autoantibodies. Second, antibodies take a long time to be developed, months, versus aptamers, which only take weeks. In this way, aptamers can be used for rapidly mutating strains like SARS or H1N1. Also, antibodies are complex biologicals, which means versus aptamers, which are synthetic, they cost significantly more, and aptamers can be delivered with much higher quality and less regulation. So, given the advantages of aptamers, there have been many companies that have been trying to commercialize and compete in this area. Aptitude Medical Systems has a significant advantage. To begin with performance, The key to performance is both affinity and specificity. These are benchmarks that indicate the likelihood of getting false positives or false negatives in your test. AMS reports the highest performance in both of these categories. We also have expertise in diagnostics, and we have the most validated aptamers to date. So how do we get this strong competitive advantage? We have this because we approach the problem from a new angle. As engineers, we understand the fundamental physics of the aptamer identification process, and we exploit microfluidics to enable the fastest turnaround, the most efficient process, and most importantly, the highest performance. These advantages require our platform. They're simply not possible without it. And this platform can be used for multiple targets as well. We have a patent pending on this platform, and we are in negotiations with the TIA to get the exclusive license. We also have another patent in preparation, which is evidence of our commitment to continuous innovation. We also have 5 years of innovative R&D experience on this subject with 12 high-impact journal publications, two of which have been featured in the prestigious Nature publication, SciBusiness Exchange. This exposure has brought both academic and industry collaborators to our lab, including people like the father of stem cells, Jamie Thompson, featured here on Time Magazine, and companies like Novartis and MedImmune. We are currently working with these companies and will continue to do so. AMS has also gained significant traction with local companies, having spun out of this successful lab model. We have had meetings with C-level executives at these local companies, and from these, we have already compiled a list of targets for which these companies want aptamers. These companies fit into the antibody-based diagnostics market, which is a $12 billion segment of the larger in vitro diagnostics market. Our aptamers could compete head-to-head with these antibodies, but it would be needlessly risky at this early stage. Instead, we can focus on what others simply cannot do, which includes creating a new market segment 4, aptamer-based diagnostics for challenging clinical targets. AMS targets key opinion leaders in academia who are seeking novel research tools to enable key functionality that they could not otherwise achieve. In exchange, we can get early revenue and third-party validation. We also have, diagnostic companies are also seeking our aptamers to expand their product line or to get a competitive advantage through improved performance. In exchange, we can get high volume and high margins. Our revenue model focused on our industry contracts adopts a value-based pricing scheme based on industry standards. We act as an independent research firm adopting aptamer identification service or supplying aptamer identification service for $250,000 per employee per year. Upon delivery of aptamers with required quality measures, we receive $100,000 milestone payments. Should the company then decide to include their aptamer in a final diagnostic product, we would get $500,000 for an exclusive license fee upfront and 5% royalties for their sales. We reach early contracts through existing connections and collaborations, and contracts will grow as we increase our capacity and our reputation. We have low capital costs and early revenue, which means we can break even as early as year 2. And this is all because we have completed significant R&D, we have customers in place, and we're ready to provide our aptamers as products. This greatly mitigates the risk of this venture. Further ahead, you can see that our revenues and margins increase significantly as our royalty payments begin to come in. By year 8, $12 million in expense results in $68 million in revenue. The exit strategy that we envision is acquisition by a large life science diagnostics company, and there's significant merger and acquisition activity taking place in this area currently. We expect to get 20-fold return to our investors. We have an experienced team to help make this vision a reality, including the 3 founders with combined research experience of 12 years in this area, as well as our academic advisor, Professor Tom So, who is a world leader in this area and very well connected. Our executive advisor, Robin Campbell, is an industry expert and can connect us with customers, as well as our legal team that's well supportive. We plan to get a business development expert in the future to gain high-value corporate contracts. In summary, Aptitude Medical Systems is an excellent investment opportunity with a very low capital requirement and early revenue generator. We have significant traction already at this date through product, IP, and customers. We have an experienced management team with successful track record in making successful ventures happen. We request $500,000 in seed funding and expect to return 20-fold or more to our investors within 5 years. We invite you to join us in enabling long, healthy lives for everyone.
I want to understand the risks associated with the synthesis of the nanoparticles, the consistency of them, and your quality control. So there's really sort of a two-phase question in there. One is the synthesis process, and is it under control? Is it capital intensive? But the other one is, what is your expectation for a rapid liquidity event?
Okay. So. Hello. So regarding the quality control issue, this is actually a major advantage of this technology. So the initial phase involves a custom identification procedure, at which point we identify a DNA sequence which is able to bind very specifically and sensitively to the target. Once this DNA sequence is identified, it can then be used it can be replicated through commoditized synthesis techniques, which are of excellent quality control.
So basically, these aptamers can be chemically synthesized. Comparing to antibody, you have to produce them in cell lines in people.
And how about the speed of a liquidity event?
The speed and liquidity? Okay, so for example, you can order...
No.
Oh.
In my earlier issue about if I pretended I was chairman of a major diagnostics company, and I'd say, why don't we buy it from these guys now?
Mm-hmm. So we can begin to produce right away, actually.
No. By the firm.
By the firm, oh! Well, we would certainly entertain such negotiations.
Okay, I see.
I see.
So, Scott, quick question. I love what you guys are planning to do. What will be like, as you know, in early stages of a company, first five or seven people you hire sets up the DNA of the company. So what are the first five in terms of key skill sets you need to bring in to supplement the team?
Okay, so I did mention the business development person. So in addition, we would also like to have a CEO with experience in this area. And we would also like to have a staff scientist as well, who could then begin to train other people while our chief technological team can focus on the actual research and improving the technology over time. And the remaining two, we would like to focus them on essentially sales of this.
So how about on the manufacturing side? Because a lot of times in these kind of things, manufacturing is a key aspect. So you think you have the skill sets you need on that side, some experience?
So again, the manufacturing of these aptamers themselves, once they've been identified, this is something that is completely outsourceable. So we actually just do the initial, like the scientists will actually do the initial aptamer identification part. This is where all the value lies. And then the actual making of that is done by someone else.
Outsourced. Okay.
So, first off, this was very impressive as far as the business plan and everything. I enjoyed learning about this, and I think it was actually kind of fascinating that I could actually understand it.
Thank you.
One thing that, there was a couple, two things that I wondered about. One, you mentioned exclusive licensing, and I can clearly see how profitable that could be, but it could also be a way for somebody to tie up, like, you know, once you've located the thing that produces the right markers or whatever, I'll just get an exclusive license and continue to sell my overly expensive thing or something like that. So you want to watch out for that, some sort of performance guarantees or something like that. But also, what is protectable about these? And I mean, in other words, it's just, if it's so simple that you can just manufacture it chemically, how is it protectable that you can even offer an exclusive license?
So basically, it's the sequence themselves that give this molecule its binding capabilities, and that is protectable, similar to software.
So it would just be a chemical sequence patent?
Correct.
So you'd have the same sort of lifetime?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And how, I mean, this is going to be very disruptive to the installed base, especially if you really can produce what you're claiming here. Are you guys prepared for those sort of battles that are going to take place with it being so disruptive? And there's a lot of money in this industry, as you are well aware.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm so.
We expect significant preparation will be required for that. In the early stage, again, we want to focus on the areas that have less competition and will be sort of accepted without as much trouble, essentially.
Aptamer development is one of the advantages is the speed with which you can develop it. And given that that's the case, does that correlate to how long it takes to get a patent for that same thing? Or are you going to develop the aptamer and then have a long waiting period while you wait for a patent?
That's actually a very good question. We definitely plan on hiring significant legal representation to help us with that patent structure. As far as engaging with the companies that would actually do this, for them to use the aptamers immediately in their products, we expect actually a significant lag. For example, the company will require slight modifications to whatever existing platform they have in which the new diagnostic substance is incorporated. And if it's for a completely new target, there may be FDA regulations that are required as well, which will basically give some time to set up the appropriate IP.
Okay, on a kind of different topic, you talk about a 20x multiple and you talk about $500,000. Mm-hmm. So assuming I'm willing to write you a check for $500,000, how do you set up the cap structure at the front end of the business to what percentage of the business are you buying? How do you structure that cap table to give a framework for that $500,000?
Right, so we're... Did you want to say something, Jim?
No.
Okay. So we're in the process of setting that up right now, but we believe what we would like to negotiate around is on the order of 15% for that $500,000.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chambers. This is Danny Tarkashian, and we are Dermatex.
And I just want everyone out in the crowd right now just to think of someone that they know that has diabetes. Just think for a second. I personally have two people in my family that have diabetes, and one of them has foot ulcers.
If you don't know anyone, that's actually quite surprising, because right now it's 1 in 10 Americans that have diabetes. So our company, Dermatex, has developed a clothing that's infused with advanced polymers, and this coating addresses chronic skin conditions. Our coating has two optimized properties. The first property is moisture balance, and this basically retains moisture within the foot so it keeps all its natural oils. And the second property is a reduction in friction between the skin and the actual fabric.
And a few of the chronic skin conditions that are targeted by Dermatex are diabetes, psoriasis, eczema. And some examples of some of the clothing that we're developing right now is socks, underwear, undershirts, and also gloves.
So our sock is infused with an advanced polymer, and this polymer addresses... This polymer addresses skin conditions, and our initial product is a white cotton blend athletic sock.
And the one thing that we have with our coating that we can put on the fabric is we could tune it linearly, so we can manipulate what we want the fabric to do between the skin and the wearer's foot. And here's just a quick drawing of our first product, Dietex. There's a loose elastic band around the ankle that will improve circulation, and also a seamless toe box to avoid additional friction between the skin and the wearer's foot.
So our first product is a sock, and it was designed to address the two primary symptoms of a diabetes foot. These two symptoms are loss of hydration as well as friction. Diabetes patients suffer from loss of autonomic control, which leads to reduced hydration, and this in turn leads to very dry feet, which become irritated by any type of friction, and that results in massive tissue damage. Neuropathy also further perpetuates this problem because with excessive nerve damage, the patient loses sensation to feel pain as well as ulceration.
And here's a quick video of our product in action. The sock on the right is not coated with our proprietary coating, and the sock on the left is. As you can see, as the water sits on top of the fabric, it's absorbing into the fibers, which poses a huge problem for people with diabetes foot problems. As a person's walking around, their feet will rub against the sock and it will develop ulceration. On the left, being able to retain moisture in the foot at the optimized balance will reduce friction and also keep the foot hydrated. Now I'll talk to you a little bit about the market. Right now, 25.8 million people in the United States have type 1 or type 2 diabetes. We have identified that 6.45 million people do have diabetes foot-related issues. The CDC predicts that by 2050, 1 in 3 Americans will have developed diabetes. Right now, 1 in 10 have diabetes. The growth is exponential. And last year, Medicare spent a whopping $1.5 billion directly related to diabetes foot care. And within our market, there's two different markets that lie. There's a premium and generic market segment. We find ourselves in the premium market in the price range of $19 to $50, and the generic market is between $5 and $15. And here's a quick breakdown of diabetes by age. The pink, light blue, and dark blue bar indicate the predominant portion of our target market, which is 45 years and older. That's more than 75% of the market. Diabetes in the world is growing rapidly. In China and also India, diabetes by 2030 is expected to double. So we definitely have the global market in mind with our product.
These are some of the competitors in the premium market. And we're basically turning the sock industry upside down and thus need a marketing tactic that will help us transform the industry. Our marketing strategy is not following the beaten path that all of these competitors have followed. Instead, we're going to aggressively market our product to diabetes and foot care professionals, and in this way we will gain validity as well as recognition. The first step in our marketing concept is to focus our attention on our relationship with the Samsung Diabetes Research Institute. This institute is nationally recognized and located right here in Santa Barbara. After pitching our idea to the top 8 researchers at the Samsung Institute, they have decided to partner with us to begin clinical trials on our product. They have agreed that we have tapped into an unmet need within the diabetes community. Since FDA approval is not necessary to put product to market, we will be using these trials purely as a marketing strategy. They will be patient satisfaction trials, and the results will be to provide validity to our product, validate support from patients as well as doctors, gain the tacit endorsement of the organization that helped us put on the trials, as well as produce academic papers that we can use throughout the rest of our marketing strategy. These trials should take between 3 to 6 months, and the result of the clinical trials will be published in internationally recognized podiatry as well as diabetes journals. These papers will be sent out to research institutes as well as podiatrists throughout the country. During our clinical trials and after, we will be leveraging the relationships that we create with podiatrists as well as diabetes professionals. Physicians today are always looking for a new source of revenue. So when we contact podiatrists, we will be asking them to endorse our product and thus receive a portion of our sales. By using professionals to sell our product, we will sell directly to the people in need, as well as make much more of a profit than if we sold to large retail chains. We will also be marketing at various conferences throughout the year. One conference we are specifically targeting is the American Diabetes Association's 71st Scientific Sessions. This is held every June, and the conference has upwards of 17,000 diabetes professionals in attendance. We will also be contacting the 7 podiatry schools throughout the United States, as well as promoting our product through diabetes and podiatry journals. Lastly, we will be using our online store to sell directly to the consumer. Our second tier strategy is to promote our socks on the late night television promotional ads.
And we have identified multiple suppliers in the United States and also in Asia that can produce our product anywhere in the range of $1 to $3. And we're hoping to produce our product in the United States just to position ourselves in a safe proprietary position. And we plan on entering into contracts to produce our products within 3 months. And with all of our suppliers, we will have them sign a non-disclosure agreement.
So the reason we can get all of this done so quickly is that we have the right team. Danny Tarkeshian is a senior in business economics as well as the president of the Student Entrepreneurs Association. I'm a junior graduating this year from the psychology department here at UCSB, and I'll be receiving my technology management certificate. Our advisors include John Wilczek, who is a serial entrepreneur. He's had over 5 successful companies in either the technology or medical arenas, and one very big success in a pharmaceutical company. Jeff McKinney is our second advisor, as well as the inventor of our product. He has vast experience in the material coding industry, and he is also doing all of our IP for our product.
And right now, we have filed 2 provisional patents to protect our idea. And once we do bring our product to market, we will implement a foreign filing strategy to further protect our idea. And to protect all of our marketing and brand name, we will file all necessary trademarks. And right now, no one else knows how to produce this as inexpensively as we do, and we're the only ones that know how to do it, so we have a trade secret. And we are establishing our company as a C corporation in Delaware. What we need from investors, we need $250,000 to really go out and prove this and do the additional market research that we need to do. We're going to take care of our clinical trial and also bring more people on staff to help us with sales. Investor returns within 3 to 5 years should be expected in the 10x to plus range. And with all of our market and our marketing strategy, we feel like we know that we add a lot of intrinsic value to our company for a successful exit. Here's a quick graph of our financials for the first 3 years of operation. In 2011, we're going to be doing our clinical trials. In 2012, we plan on having our products in 150 podiatrist office, and that will be right around $2 million in sales. And then in 2014, we plan on having our products in 3,000 doctors' offices with approximately $70 million in sales.
So why Dermatex? Why invest in us? First of all, we have the right team. Both Danny and I are on board to start this company as soon as we graduate. Secondly, we have the proprietary know-how. No one else knows how to do this as inexpensively and efficiently as we do.
And our market is growing exponentially. The fact that by 2050, 1 in 3 people will have developed diabetes is exponential growth. And the market is extremely underserved. Thank you so much.
This plan is clearly dependent on a quality product, a terrific product. High-wicking polymer-coated fabrics have been around for a long time. Both wicking and friction resistance are measurable data, so you ought to be able to compare your product specifically with hard data against competing products. I didn't see the data. Does the data exist? What's so special about your product, since it seems to me that polymer coating fabrics have been around for a long, long time?
The polymer coating that is on the market right now, they all have the same properties, which is that they wick water and moisture away from the skin. They take out all the moisture that's inside of the skin. So our coating actually keeps the moisture inside of the sock to allow all the natural oils and everything stay in there. And that's one of the main problems that diabetes patients have, because they get really dry feet. So they're actually told not to wear performance fabrics because it takes all the moisture away from their foot.
And the whole idea of our product is just to turn the whole diabetes sock market upside down and go with a different idea, to where we're actually going to keep the water in instead of pulling it out, because as tissue gets more damaged, it further perpetuates the problem.
My cotton socks don't have anything on them and they're wet half the time.
We'll have to make you a good sock then.
Thank you.
I think the key aspect, as you said, this is at the end of the day, it's a consumer product, so marketing is the key. So I was just I think it's a very interesting market segment, trying to understand if you've done analysis of what's the levers you need to put in terms of, if you, instead of $250,000, if you had to spend $1 million first year on the marketing side, what does, because reaching to some of the podiatrists and stuff, because it's really, you have to reach out to those people so that they can promote your product, and you talked about late night TV and stuff. So marketing dollars is gonna be your major expense here. Have you kind of tried to do different kind of analysis as to what's the optimal spend in year one or year two, and how does that affect the sales?
I don't have an exact answer for you on exactly how much the marketing is going to cost, but while we're doing our clinical trials over the next 6 months, we're going to be holding focus groups weekly so we can identify how much marketing dollars we need to spend and also where we need to allocate that money.
Okay, and a quick follow-on. For the people who you are expecting to be referring your product, is there any economics for them? Or is there a model like where podiatrists, do they sell these kind of things out of their offices?
Yeah, absolutely. The one thing that we've found with doing our research is we wanted to be able to hit the keystone mark for retailers, but we're selling directly through doctors. So our plan right now, which probably will change in the next couple months, is we're going to sell each bundle in a bundle of three, which we're going to sell that for to the doctors for $30, and then they'll be able to sell it for $59.
Okay.
So it'll be able, for both parties, it'll be
Thank you.
Thank you. Good presentation. You guys come across really well. I appreciate that. One of the things you made note of is that you have the proprietary know-how, and you talk about the polymers, and you talk about the differences, you know, sort of following on to the first question. But I have to go back to and say polymers are pretty well known, and if the only if it's what is it about your polymers that will cause doctors to say, hey, I'm going to refer this sock. I'm going to tell my people to buy this sock or whatever, and how are you really going to protect it? I mean, how different is your polymer versus many, many other polymers that might be able to synthesize to give the same effect? So I guess two things. How are you going to get the referrals that are necessary to build the market presence that you need, to get the market penetration, and you know, what's the barrier to the competition?
Okay, well, from our inventor, he's told us that people have been trying to do this for years, but they've never, and they have been able to create a coating that's similar, but it's always been too expensive for them to market and make money off of. So this is, as of right now, we are the only people that know how to do this. To get it into doctors' offices, we're really hoping that our relationship with the Samsung Institute is going to promote our sales and provide validity. So even though we're going to be starting our marketing and sales before we finish all of our clinical trials, we're hoping that we can just leverage that relationship. When we went to present, as you have pointed out, it is kind of opposite to what you would think that a piece of clothing would do to help someone with that has skin conditions. And that's, we really thought it was a great idea, but we wanted to make sure, and that's why we went to the Institute, and they really validated our idea. They came up to us after and told us that we have an unmet need that they really think is going to help out their community.
And also, many of the companies that are already on the market, we've looked to see if they were trying to approach our market in the same way that we are. And no other companies like Dr. Scholl's are approaching it exactly how we are, going straight through the podiatrists and selling from their venues. And we plan on harnessing that with our clinical trial.
So I assume then that you surveyed the market and asked podiatrists if there's enough room in their facilities to carry inventory.
Yeah, we've talked to a number of podiatrists. I've had a few say that they have never sold anything out of their office, but that they'd be open to the idea. And then there have been a few that they do sell products outside of from inside their office. A lot of podiatrists also have online stores that they take other people's products and sell it through that. So if they don't have enough room in their facilities, we also have gone down the thinking path to have them give out our online website and then figure out a way to get them the recognition of getting that customer to us.
So you'd compensate them even if they didn't carry the inventory?
Yes.
And what do you think needs to be done in the way of clinicals in order to establish for reasonable proof or that your product is superior to those on the market?
Right now, we're in talks with the Institute to talk about exactly how to design the study. We know that we need to validate the idea against other products. That's one of the main issues that we have to deal with. But it really depends on how we need to design our trial, and that needs to come later in more negotiations.
We have a few endpoints in mind that will be advantageous for our marketing positions, and we're working with a biostatistician over the next 6 months to make sure that we hit the endpoints that we need to hit to market our product in the near future.
And then two questions related to finance. The first one in terms of sources and uses of capital. If somebody gave you $250,000, how would you deploy that capital? And the second question that's the second part of that is, how do you develop the capital structure for the company? What does that $250,000 do for the investor?
The $250,000 is going to get us through and actually going out to prove our idea. $50,000 we're projecting right now is going to go straight towards the clinical trial, and then also we're going to have to provide product for the clinical trial and do marketing. What that money is going to cover is additional market research and also possibly bringing a alpha or beta test into a small market within the next 6 months to a year after the clinical trial.
Did that answer?
The second part of that question is $250,000, and what does it buy an investor?
What will it provide the investor with a return?
Well, not necessarily a return. What percentage of the company is he buying?
With that, we plan on negotiating that, and we would be more than happy to meet up. But if you were thinking anywhere in the range of 5 to 20% possibly, it just depends on the situation.
Okay.
Good, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This is Billy, Chris, and Joel, and we are Athlete Performance Data Systems. APDS is Salesforce.com for the athletic world. Now, let me give you a bit of background in case you don't know what Salesforce.com is. They generated over $1.8 billion in revenue just last year in solving communication and efficiency problems for the business world. Now, this is what we do in the athletic world, and right now, what we are doing for college athletic departments. College athletics is a huge business for their universities. Last year, $3.4 billion in revenue just from licensing deals, media deals, and ticket sales. That doesn't even begin to account for the alumni donations and what the athletics do for the brand of the universities. The problem then becomes is that when athletes who are at the center of the athletic organizations get injured, things suffer. According to NCAA injury data, injuries are going up, and this is an especially big problem with star athletes. Now, APDS is here to help whatever problems that the athletic departments have in efficiency and communication in caring for their athletes. We want to help to take care of the departments and their athletes as they heal and as they are cared for. The APDS web application solves these problems for athletic program in the same way that Salesforce.com solves these problems for the business world, by improving efficiency and communication. Now, let me give you a brief example from the athletic world. I'd like you to meet David. He's a swimmer here at UCSB, and let's follow him as he takes a journey through the athletic department if he were to get injured. His first stop would be to see Kelly, his athletic trainer. Unfortunately, Kelly would probably not be able to see him for 3 full days because of all the paperwork and problems that she has to get through every day just for her normal workload. After seeing Kelly, Diana would come in, and she would fill out insurance reimbursement forms and check to make sure that everything is working all right. But if David didn't fill out his pre-participation paperwork, that makes Diana's job really damn hard. If David didn't have the right forms in, he should have never been at practice. He should have never been touched by Kelly, and he definitely cannot compete until this is fixed. Meanwhile, David's head coach Greg and his strength coach Ross, they're left in the dark because of federal privacy laws that prevent anybody from telling these two coaches an athlete is injured by email, by voicemail, by text message, even by a written note left on somebody's desk. These are communication problems that leaves Greg wondering how to fill a hole in his schedule and his roster, and Ross is going to have to come up with a new strength program for David on the fly. These are problems in inefficiency and paperwork and problems in communication that are endemic in national athletic departments nationwide. Now, UCSB athletic staff, they routinely spend half of their day on paperwork like injury reports, athlete information, insurance forms, NCAA compliance forms, and required health records. I mean, every season, each athlete fills out 20 pages of forms just to get in the door. Now, multiply this problem by 450 athletes, and that's just at UCSB. What about 969 athletes at Ohio State? This is a problem that departments nationwide have, and APDS is the solution. Now, let's go through this again if UCSB was using APDS. David, he would fill out all of his pre-participation paperwork online, where it would be validated and checked instantly. Kelly, she would enter all of her notes directly into our web application the first time, so she could save time and have more time to see her other athletes. Diane, she would be able to fill out all the insurance reimbursement forms and also check all of the athlete's compliance without ever leaving her browser. And then Greg and Ross, they could get secure messages instantly if any of their athlete's status changes. Now, APDS is solving a problem that these departments have in efficiency and communication by offering this software as a service to departments nationwide. Now, the APDS system is currently being developed in a very close partnership with UCSB. Because honestly, if developing software without real users is usually very, very difficult. We want to make something that athletic trainers and coaches actually want to use. And we're trying to approach this in a new way from others in this space. We see data as a huge asset. More data means better decisions and better ideas of what's going on. We are building something that is able to properly collect and display anonymized health data from the beginning so that an organization can get a competitive edge and view their individual athlete, their team, their sport, or even an entire conference and get an idea of what is affecting their performance. Now, for APDS, we are asking only 20 cents per day per athlete from athletic departments. And the total addressable market just in collegiate athletics is $46 million a year. This doesn't even account for other adjacent markets, which I'll get to in a second. Now, collegiate athletics is a very close-knit and community that has a common shared problem. And we are going to be using a combination of direct sales as well as word of mouth to go and find our next clients. Additionally, we are going to have a major presence at the NCAA conferences, like the National Athletic Trainers Association Conference and NCAA staff conferences. This is how we are going to be growing our business in the collegiate market. However, we also see APDS as a great fit for other markets. Parts of APDS would be a great fit for professional sports, for physical therapy centers, and for gyms and fitness centers. In each one of these markets, that's a total addressable market of well over $1 billion each. So we are taking a system that we are developing for collegiate athletics, then getting real-world usage data, and then grow it into a much, much larger business in these adjacent markets. So long-term, we're going for a flexible product with a lot of possibility. Short-term, we're going to be going after 1,000 schools that are the top schools in the programs, and we're going to be growing our business in that manner. Now let's talk about our competition. Our biggest competition is paper. I mean, paper is used in some fashion by most departments nationwide. It works, it's relatively simple, until it's not, as I've been talking about. For some departments, they do have software solutions that they are trying to use. But these software solutions do not think of data as an asset. They restrict their pricing to be per user, so not everybody can use the system. That means that data gets lost and that doesn't go in. APDS has a site license that means that everyone can put data into our system and use it and be more effective with it. We have unique features like secure messaging and pre-participation paperwork. And other than an electronic health record system that is for doctors and clinics, we are the only one to offer insurance reimbursement as a basic part of our service. Now, there is a competitor that is adjacent to us called Jump Forward, and they have a similar philosophy to us and are looking at similar things with similar technology. But they are solely focused on NCAA recruiting rules. And we are taking them as a test case for this approach and watching and learning from them as they get into this market. Now, let's talk about our projections. We think that in 2012, we can have 45 schools on the APDS system, and by 2013, in first quarter, be profitable. And then by 2016, have almost 600 schools on the APDS system for a profit of over $11 million per year. And again, this is just for collegiate athletics. In 2013, with a finished product, we are going to be going after adjacent markets hard. Now, What we are looking for is $250,000 in friends and family seed funding and $750,000 in angel funding in 2013 to fund our expansion. We are working very, very closely with UCSB and have a development timeline that has our minimally viable product in front of customers by August 1st. Our advisors, we're working closely with them for compliance, coaching, training, and strength training issues to make a product that people want to use. And our team is comprised of all former athletes, and we are very passionate about this problem and in making people's lives better. We are Athlete Performance Data Systems. Thank you.
One of my takeaways is that the strength coach looks the same whether he's happy or mad.
We tried to get some emotion, but that's how he is.
It's okay. I think your strategy makes some sense of starting with the NCAA system and move up. But the NCAA system includes lots and lots of large public universities that have no money and are not known for investing in efficiency, to put it nicely. How do you crack into it? Or to say it maybe another way, how successful have you been in cracking into it here, i.e. getting paid?
I mean, we are currently working on a development contract to get paid for this for UCSB. We're in talks. The thing that we have been finding, though, is the athletic departments are well-funded. They have a unique aspect in college life where, say, for UC Berkeley, because of athletics, university athletics was responsible for 10% of contributions to the academic program. Supporting athletics makes sense for the rest of the programs, for the rest of the academic institutions. And according to data that we have found published by the Department of Education under Title IX, most athletic departments, they are running a very significant profit year to year.
Okay, thank you.
I think that was going to be, I think, my comment in the terms of that you might want to consider going after some of the adjacent markets, especially physical therapy, sooner rather than later, because there are some of the smaller businesses where if you save their money, it goes directly in their pocket, and the motivation level tends to be higher. And also kind of consider alternate models, because a lot of times selling into school systems, you are on an annual budget cycle. So if you miss out by a few months, you might have another wait of 9 months or so. But I think overall, plan does make sense. There seems to be a need for that. So the sector that has not been automated, so that's good.
Thank you.
Very interesting business plan, great, compelling presentation. I have a few questions for you guys. One of the things that struck me was you've done at least some surveying amongst some of the local sports programs, and you understand there's some commonality in the UC system and so on. But I wonder how far you've reached outside to understand the commonality amongst the sports programs and how they operate, and will they want to track things the same way that you can truly establish a platform approach like you're trying to do? Okay, that's the first part of it. The second part is when you have a platform approach like this, I see these sort of solutions often, and the biggest problem they have is they come in and they want their platform to be the center of the universe, and all of a sudden you've got all these old legacy systems that you have to figure out how to integrate. You have to do data conversion. You've got, you know, those piles of paper. How do you get those into the system? And what do you do if they say, oh no, we don't want this module or that module, we want you to integrate it with our existing stuff? And pretty soon you collapse under, you know, just the support weight of trying to come up with all those customizable solutions.
Chris,
I'll take the first one. So we've only talked to schools in California directly, but talking to the athletic trainers, they state that schools like Yale, University of Connecticut, have the same exact problems and that it is endemic throughout the entire country. It is a valid point that getting them to adopt our system will be hard at first, but every school that we have talked to has said that there is a dire need right now, and they're willing to look at our solution, which we haven't even finished developing yet.
And I think that the talks that I've had so far have been very optimistic in the fact that they're willing to take time out of their busy day to actually discuss that they are looking for a better solution.
And to answer the second part of your question in terms of why they will adopt our platform, essentially what we're creating is we're creating a platform that is the base where they are able to customize the inputs. For example, if they have a unique injury or a unique classification for an injury, they enter that into our system, and our system will recognize that, so the next time they enter an ankle injury, for say, it will withdraw from the history so that their unique data inputs are forefront, whereas we're not trying to make them conform to a specific platform.
And then as far as your aspect of integrating with current technologies, one reason we are in University Athletics is because there's a four-year turnover. New athletes come in every year, and if they are able to enter into our system, we minimize the support costs of trying to knit together legacy information as those as these students come into our system, and old students can come out. I mean, this is something that we're going to have to work with our customers on, and try to find a way that we can still make a profit and be able to provide the service.
Okay, thanks. You addressed almost everything. The one final aspect that I still didn't quite get comfortable with was, say, for example, you go into a place and they have a fairly sophisticated, power training software suite that they're using, and yours doesn't meet their needs. You have to integrate that with the rest of your platform and make it all talk together and so on. And you're often going to face that whenever you try to go in and say, look, here's all five of our modules. They're going to say, okay, I only want these three, and you need to integrate with our other two.
Okay.
So have you thought about that?
What we found is that's common at schools that have medical schools that also have athletic teams. They like to have a common solution where they can actually take their athletes just to the medical school. But one thing that we found as well is UC Davis, for example, this is what they do, but they just told me that they're looking for another solution because they just had a security breach with their custom-made solution. And we do foresee difficulties doing this because there are many schools that have medical schools as well. So we would like to target the schools without the medical schools before that, and then go from there.
I mean, in our experience, the solutions that they have are so terrible that they're willing to try anything else. But we can run into this problem.
That's the best answer I've heard. Truly. And you're probably absolutely right. It's like you can go in and convince them that the platform approach and your solutions are sufficient and give them the total picture. Thanks.
As you know, we're over here grading your performance. So, the first thing I want to comment on is that I really like your presentation. You solve a real problem. And a lot of times there's a solution looking for a problem and ways in which you can solve it. So this was a real problem. I like the comparison to Salesforce.com. The communication aspects of it, it's great. I like using the cloud. I think that's a great way, that using the Amazon. How do you keep it secure?
So the technology part aspect of this is it's possible to make secure systems in the Amazon cloud. The federal requirements require encryption at rest of health information as well as in flight. And we have a system that is set up specifically for this. Actually, I have a slide up for this.
We have a slide for this. But essentially what we've been counting on is creating individual private clouds for each university. So by structuring it this way, they are going to be in their own secure environments.
I mean, it's really about limiting the access of these systems to the public internet, and then partitioning and sharding the individual servers and their databases from each other. So, and then also having a very strict plan of key rotation and access management that Amazon Web Services now enables. This is something that we are working very hard to do right from the beginning. Other firms, they're not able to go online because they didn't build in security from the beginning. But we're taking a very long and hard look at it. Does that answer your question?
It answers the question that you understand the problem. Do you really believe your guys are going to be able to sell 15 systems a year?
We have a very aggressive sales strategy, and we think that getting out there and talking to our customers, I believe that we can make that.
And do you believe there will be no ramp up in those people? I mean, you have three guys, you have 45 systems, it's real simple, it looks good in a spreadsheet. Do you see a real ramp like that? I mean, my experience with sales organizations is they don't ramp quite that way.
I think our biggest concern is support costs. A lot of what we're dealing with is universities. They're the most fickle market out there. But in terms of ramping up and scaling, one of the things that we found was that we contacted Cal Poly, and Cal Poly contacted UCSB and then got back to us immediately, and they said that they wanted to talk. This is an example of that there's such a great need that the universities are already talking. UCSB alone has already networked out to UCLA, Cal Poly, Loyola Marymount, and other schools just on word of mouth alone. And when we introduce ourselves, they already have a good idea of who we are and what we're trying to do.
But I do understand your concerns. And we're just going to have to try very, very hard to get out there and get experience in this market and see if we can make that.
I'd love your plan. As a former college athlete, I think that, had we had this kind of tool available to us, it would have been a magic tool for us. So I wish you a lot of luck.
Great. Thank you.
Beginning of mankind, competition has been a necessary and desired activity. An activity which wagering can bring to the next level. In 2009, internet gambling grossed $26 billion, a huge number expected to increase further, according to the American Gaming Association. The difference between gambling and wagering is that gambling involves games of chance, such as poker, and is generally illegal in the United States, whereas wagering is on games of skill and generally legal in the United States. So, how are we planning on capitalizing on this industry, and what problem are we solving? Over 20 million highly competitive online PC gamers have no place to wager money on their skill. We are bringing wagering to computer games. Wagecraft is an interactive online community where gamers can wager money to compete against each other in specific computer games of skill. This activity is legal since it's considered wagering on skill rather than random numbers based in chance like poker. Also, you're wagering on your own skill as opposed to someone else's skill like we see in sport betting. For these reasons, we are not in violation of the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act of 2006, which the three largest poker sites were recently shut down for violating. We're legal in 36 states as well as internationally. And since 1999, GameColony.com has been offering its users the opportunity to wager on games of skill such as dominoes, checkers, and backgammon. Like Wagecraft, Game Colony has been in full compliance with all U.S. state and federal regulations. For those of you that remain skeptics, we currently have one of the nation's top IPO firms, Wilson Sonsini Goodrich Rosati, as our legal advisor. A survey of our target market, whose average age is 28, revealed that almost 86% of online gamers desired and would use our service. But Wagecraft is more than just a place to wager your money. It's an interactive community tailored to the users to be a place they want to hang out, check up on friends, check up on opponents. We have a ranking system in place, which not only incentivizes users to explore the site more, but also to wager more. As I mentioned before, our target market size is 20 million users and growing, and the games we'll initially offer our service to are some of the games on the Steam platform, World of Warcraft, StarCraft II, Heroes of New Earth, and League of Legends. Our market has very minimal awareness and penetration. Our two main competitors offer the service to console gamers, meaning Xbox 360 and PlayStation 3, but don't offer the opportunity to PC gamers. But more important than the fact that they don't offer this service to PC gamers is the fact that they don't have a process which relays data from their games and their user match results to seamlessly determine a winner. As a result, they rely on their users to report the winner and loser of a match. This reliance on users leads to disputes and cheating. Wagecraft has a patent pending for a business process which will seamlessly integrate with our games and the users' match results in order to eliminate disputes. One of our team members, Alex Ringe, or better known in the online gaming community as Soda, is ranked top 5 World of Warcraft players. A game with over 12 million users will be offering the service to. Capitalizing on his positive image with these millions of users, as well as access to his sponsors and advertising channels, are a couple competitive advantages he provides us. Wagecraft's business model is such that we'll charge users a percentage fee of each match they create, a percentage fee that will decrease the more they wager in order to capitalize on their willingness to pay. This percentage fee, as well as advertising partnerships with companies such as Blizzard, are just two ways to generate revenue. Our team has been close friends and highly competitive computer gamers dating back to the last century. Our respective knowledge and skills have worked together in perfect harmony working on this venture over the last year. Our initial costs are projected at $300,000 and our 5-year revenues projected at $56.5 million. These numbers are from the traffic of our competitors and the average wager that their users make. An exit strategy we have is either an IPO or perhaps a corporate buyout with one of the big gaming companies in the industry already, such as Blizzard. In summary, competitive online PC gaming and internet wagering are on a collision course, and Wagecraft is poised to pick up the pieces. Wagecraft is taking competitive online gaming to the next level, providing a service users desire. Wagecraft is the place to put your money where your mouth is. Thank you.
The first reaction I had after I read it was, oh, great, my kids can spend more time playing games and can now lose money doing so. How do you keep Game Colony and Virgin Gaming from just walking in and taking us away from you, other than Mr. Ringe, who, is he here, by the way?
I've never met a professional.
Oh, he's here. Yeah, he's here.
Where are you?
Stand up.
Stand up. There he is. Okay.
Professional gamer.
Professional gamer, Alex Ringe, everybody.
So how do you keep the others who are sort of in this space from doing what you do?
That's a great question. We are doing everything in our power to create erect barriers to entry. Alex is a small one, and our patent pending on our integration system is another way we do that. But we do know that this is a marathon, and we're doing everything we can to get out ahead of everyone else and stay there.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting idea. I mean, I think more than a question, a feedback would be, I think, focus on the operational side of it, because sometimes these things, even if there is a small hiccup, can throw off your partners and stuff. So at least as I read through the plan, I didn't feel there was enough emphasis on the operational side. It would behoove you to get somebody who's built a large, scalable system, fault-tolerant, to kind of get involved. But overall, I think it's a mixed emotions about it. I think it's a very attractive market segment. Part of me, it worries me that in our economy right now, the companies that have the highest market caps are the companies that tend to be reducing productivity of us as a nation rather than increasing it. So.
Well, both my questions had to do with barrier to entry and operational aspects. So thanks, guys. Seriously, one of the things that you noted in your business plan was how this has the likelihood of going viral, right? I mean, so how do you turn on 100 servers tomorrow? I mean, do you really understand the operational aspect of that many hits turning up overnight if this goes where it's going to go? Because that will be your moment to capture the competition, you know, get the installed base, become the grandfather of the industry, and so on. And to me, it's sort of I see that as what I saw as a weakness to understanding how difficult it is really to take something like this global and have the sort of access to it and so on and be dependable. You're talking about taking people's money. It's got to work.
Yeah, we definitely understand the magnitude of what you need to have entering this, because you need to be prepared for the amount of traffic you get. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I'm wondering how do you handle the operational ups and downs and so on, and the fact that it's got to be on, it can't go out in the middle of the game going on, and people's money and things like that.
Our process, actually, if it does go out in the video game, it's not very mission critical, I like to say. If it does go out in the middle of a game, it won't really affect what's going on with the wagers, because we will have an updating system to where the wagers will be saved and the games themselves will be played in the game. So if the game goes down, that's a problem. But our wagering system, once the money is wagered, if the whole server crashes, those wagers will be remembered, and there won't be a problem with that. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Okay. So how do you handle the elastic nature of
scaling?
The demand?
Scaling of how many people, how many users? We actually have an advisor that we recently acquired and a mentor, and he did kind of go over some of those problems with us, and it was an awakening moment for us, because we realized that, you know, we're not going to be functional in like 2 months if we're going to be able to scale that fast in the exponential growth rate that is most likely going to happen with this kind of a venture. So we are doing, we're looking into having more operational things done. We're looking into having an engineering team ready for that scalability.
Carrier-grade scalability is a necessity. I mean, you look at the numbers. So having somebody on your team that can build a fully scalable system is vital. I'm not much of a gambler, but I'll bet you 5-4 before you have 10 million users, I mean $10 million in revenue, you have three competitors that are very well funded. So that's another part of the deal that you really need to consider. I mean, Richard Branson won't give this away easily. Major League Gaming is going to be a player in the field. And more important than anything is I think that you're going to be better off targeting an agnostic system than targeting the specific games that you compete in. You'd like to be ubiquitous amongst all these games. That's the nature of being successful in the gambling world, is not one game, but lots of games. And then I have one question for you. How do you sustain, and how do you believe that you get to the number 8%, you're going to keep 8% of the wager? Where did that come from?
Competition has used 14% as a number. Now, the amount they had wagered using that system is not anywhere near what we hope to have. They had $6 million wagered over the course of 4 years. But then again, their system is very different than ours, as we've said.
We kind of asked around certain gamers what they were willing to pay. We looked through the possibility of a yearly fee just to use our service, a monthly fee, and the gamers that we were targeting they don't find that attractive. So we went with the percent rake based on how often they wager, and 8% seemed like a good fair ground.
Are you predicting any erosion of that as you scale?
Yeah, and like I mentioned, the incentivized system, so that the more they wager, that 8 would drop eventually to 5. But yes, as we scale, that number could be lowered. It's open for.
But more likely, it'll come from competition pressure, right?
Yeah. Well, the competition right now, they obviously aren't targeting our same market, but they are doing other things like monthly subscriptions and actually double our rate, almost 14%. So.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.